Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we are going to talk with Alistair MacLeod, our favorite European correspondent. You know, with the U.S. government shutdown distractions, much is slipping past, including any discussion of true budgetary, fiscal, and monetary limits, and the even more dangerous idea that the central banks have, once again, blown even larger bubbles to replace the ones that just burst. I'm quite happy to have Alistair back on as our featured guest. Alistair, thank you so much for joining us.
It's very nice to be on, Chris. It's very nice to speak to you again.
Well, listen, there's so much going on. Of course, over here, the big drama, the Sturm und Drang in the United States is, looks like they've passed a continuing resolution to allow the government to operate for just a little bit longer. And of course, there's massive relief everywhere in the equity markets, not just a U.S. phenomenon. I believe the German DAX is hitting all-time new highs, despite the fact that industrial production in the Eurozone is kind of down from even from the peak in 2008. So it looks to me like we've got a can-kicking exercise, and the intention here is we're just going to push this along a little further. It looks very political. It looks very partisan. It looks like a lot of things, but what it doesn't look to me is very substantial or in any way addressing anything structural. How do you see it from over there?
Well, I see it rather like as you've described. I think there is another aspect I would push into it, and that is that as the, if you like, as the reserve currency, the currency that is used, I think I'm right in saying, in 87% of all the world's trade transactions outside the U.S., I think the brand of the U.S. dollar, the brand image, has taken a very nasty hit. And what is interesting is that you went through a list of all the markets that have risen today. You didn't mention the dollar has really fallen very, very sharply, and gold has taken off. And I think that that probably says it all. I think the overseas bit, the overseas view is that this is something which is basically not good. It doesn't do well for the future. I can understand, on the other hand, why foreign markets, equity markets have gone better, because we all dance to the dollar's tune. If the dollar's in trouble, we're in trouble. If the dollar's in, you know, sort of smelling of roses, we all cheer loudly. So the relief rally extends internationally, and I think it's really as simple as that, Chris.
Well, Alistair, the relief seems to have been relief, A, that there was a rumor that this was all going to be solved, relief then that there was another rumor, another relief rally on the back of the idea that it would all be solved. And here we are at all-time new highs. And that would seem to be predicated on the idea, here's my problem. I can't find anything substantial, anything fundamental in this story that makes me following along with the narrative I'm supposed to follow along with, which is that there's something here that makes sense as to why we would want to be absolutely giddy, where bad news is good news and good news is good news. There's no fundamental thing in this story I can find. In fact, I have to be completely honest, I've seen this story before. I heard the same sorts of noises back when the housing prices were appreciating really strongly, back when the equity markets were doing this. I've been here before, Alistair. This is bubble territory. I know what it looks like. Bad is good. Good is good. It doesn't matter. Nothing matters until it does. So you're over there close to, I've been reading a lot about the London property market. There's nothing fundamentally right about that, is there?
Well, you're right to draw attention to that. I think the answer to the conundrum you just set is one thing, and that is the rapid expansion of the quantity of money. What's happening is that it's not so much that asset prices are rising, but in terms of the available money for those asset classes, the purchasing power of that money is going down. I think the bubble is in money. It's not in the individual asset classes. Now, of course, if they were going to do something about this rapid expansion of money and stop it, then prices of property, stock market shares, and all the rest of it would quite obviously collapse. But I can't see that that's going to happen, and I think the bet that everybody is now making is that now the can has been kicked down the road for another 11 weeks, actually, we're not going to get any tapering whatsoever. You can forget that. All we have got in prospect is the continuing production of money to keep interest rates at zero. And that, I think, explains anything. It's the money you've got to look at, I think, rather than the asset classes themselves.
Ah, the money. It's always the money. And this is a piece I've been arguing for a long time. I'm surprised, I will confess right here to everybody listening, I am very surprised that A, it's gone on this long. B, that the quantities produced have been produced without C, some sort of massive flight away from this chimerical world into stuff that's more real. In fact, commodities are down quite a bit, except for oil. Commodities are down quite a bit. That would be the grains, the softs, gold and silver, all sorts of things, which is really surprising to me because when you look at the valuations that have been placed on financial assets, it's extraordinary. And all of this can be explained through money. And I read a very interesting article that you had written recently, I think through Gold Money, and it was talking about just comparing things to the total amount of fiat money out there. Can you explain that?
Yes, absolutely. I'm trying to get a bit of a campaign on this one, so any airing of it I'm very grateful for. Basically, I set off with this task, and that is to put together a metric of money which allows me to compare sound money with fiat money. And my approach to this was to look at what happened in how fiat money was created. It originally involved, as you know, as a money substitute. In other words, you and I, or our great-grandfathers or great-great-grandfathers, would take gold to the bank. We would deposit gold in the bank for safekeeping. The bank would give us either notes, which we could, in cash, anywhere where it accepted, where that bank's credit was valuable. Alternatively, it would give us, an account, a deposit account, which would show that, yes, the bank holds this gold on behalf of Mr. Martinson. So, that was a starting point. So that was how deposits and cash were originally created, as money substitutes. Then the next thing happened, central banks were invented, and what happened was that they took over the note-issuing monopoly they created. They were given by government this note-issuing monopoly, and in return for that, all the banks within the central bank's system would take the gold that we originally deposited and move it into the central bank. In return for, guess what, deposit accounts and, nice new banknotes. So really what I wanted to do was to reverse that process or quantify that process. It involves taking cash, all the sort of instant access deposits or deposits which are readily accessible, plus the deposits that the banks have at the central bank, because that is money just as the same as your deposit account is in your bank. It is exactly the same in that sense. Nobody really includes this, but if you look at that, you get some very interesting statistics. Going from 1960 to the month before the Lehman crisis in 2008, the average exponential growth rate was at 5.9%, around about 5.9%, year right. in, year out.
Yeah.
And it followed that track very, very closely. Then, of course, we had TARP and all the rest of it, and then we had QE. And guess what? The level of fiat money quantity is now over 60% above that long-term trend line. Now, if we stand back unemotionally and look at that chart, we would say that this is monetary hyperinflation. And here we have this situation now where the central bank, the Fed, is having to produce money to finance the government deficit. It's having to produce money to keep interest rates down so that the banks don't have balance sheet problems. And if it slows down in that production of money, and even if it doesn't increase the rate of the production of that money, then our world is going to come to a rather nasty halt. So it looks like not only are we in a debt trap, but we are in, a hyperinflationary trap, potentially. And we need someone who's really quite strong and understands these things to be able to stand on the system and say no more. So my question to you, Chris, is can anyone do that? Do you think Janet Yellen will do that? I suspect I know your answer.
Let me think. You know, I probably have to go into movie characters to figure out somebody who could do that. And I understand your point. I understand it well. And this idea that we're 60% above even what I would consider, so 5.9%, anything growing 5.9% per year, which you mentioned was the long-term or recent trend for monetary accumulation, that's an exponential function, which I'm going to do some math in my head, call it 6% to make it easy on myself. That means every 13 to 14 years, it's going to be doubling. Fully doubling. And of course, now when we look at the average income, the real wage of an average person, we can go back much more than 13 or 14 years and find out that that hasn't doubled. In fact, it's dead flat. So what you're talking about is this idea that what we're doing is we're doubling the monetary base at what was once a 5.9% rate. Now we're 60% above that. I have to ask, is that a lot? But it's that means that we are now have much, much, much faster doubling times. And the Fed is doing this and doing all of this, I would submit, because it's the monetary system that requires it. You don't require it. I don't require it. The people who are trying to live their lives and abide by the rules, they don't require it. Nobody requires it, but institutions do. The banks do. The Federal Reserve does. The politicians do. This is the holy, unholy triumvirate that we're in. And I think that's what got peeled back and exposed a little bit in this whole debacle in Washington, D.C., which, by the way, is probably the same debacle playing out in Italy and Spain and Greece and Ireland and soon coming to a theater near you. And that is that we had this long-running idea that we could perpetually, exponentially expand our money at a rate that was faster than underlying economic growth and that everything would somehow pencil out at the end. And that's been exposed, A, as a broken model. Lots of people are figuring that out now. But B, the level of dysfunction in our elected officials who have only known how to distribute ever larger pieces of a growing pie are clueless, lost, lambs in the dark when it comes to what do we do when we have to prioritize and we can't promise everybody everything. That's really what I think got exposed here a little bit. And so what I love about what you're illustrating here is, listen, we can just take an objective measure of the monetary supply and look at that. And that tells us a couple of things. First, what should price levels of things be? Guess what? Those price levels, if history is any guide, will catch up to the monetary supply at some point, not the other way around. And the second thing is that you can look at all those years, many years, decades of that monetary expansion and understand that the people who are currently in power, that's all they know. It's like they grew up on the moon and you bring them to Earth and gravity is just befuddling them. How do you see it?
I completely agree with what you say. One of the things that's interesting in this, which I think is a dynamic which is going to play out over the next, I don't know, few months, is here we are expanding the quantity of money hugely. But at the same time, what we're not seeing is the prices of raw materials, of things like that, really reflecting that expansion of money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is always a time lag between the two effects. But actually, we are seeing this effect, certain things, in the way in which one would expect. And that is that asset prices, particularly things like property, are beginning to rise. I'd also draw your attention to the fact that prices in the financial centers for everything are considerably higher than they are elsewhere.
Hmm.
Now, this is a reflection of the fact that bankers and lawyers and all the rest of it are making an awful lot of money out of this largesse from the central banks, and they're spending it locally. They're spending it in the restaurants. They're spending it on improving their homes. They're spending it on buying new country homes and all the rest of it. So, you know, they drive up prices around them. And you can see this in New York. I just come back from London today, and my goodness, I see it in spades in London. So this effect, which is called the Cantillon effect, where prices rise where the new money goes in, we're beginning to see that. And it's spreading. And I think it's spreading in two ways, in the UK anyway. And I'd be interested in your comments on the US. In the UK, house prices are now beginning to move quite rapidly. They are moving very rapidly. in London and anywhere within commuting distance of London. And that is now spreading away from London, so that house prices, houses which were difficult to shift, are now beginning to shift in the market deep into the country. The second thing I see is that the man in the street can see that new cars can be bought on zero credit. Now, this is a turnaround from how cars used to be sold. Car manufacturers over here used to make more money on the credit than they did out of selling the car. Now what they're doing in order to shift stock is they've cut the cost of finance down to virtually zero and effectively incorporated the discount in the price of the car. So what people are doing is they're saying to themselves, I can buy a brand new Volkswagen or whatever it is, and the cost of finance from Volkswagen is going to be zero. Now, if I take out a five-year loan, that can look very clever because interest rates are going to be higher in 5 years. So I think I should take the opportunity and go and buy a new motor car. And that's what's happening. And this is another way in which the whole of this production of money, all this fiat money, is beginning to leak into the economy. It will also, by the way, drive up GDP, because all GDP is a money total. And I think this is why people are beginning to get a little more confident that we've got economic recovery. But on that, there is a secondary effect which they're not taking into account, and it's going to make it very, very difficult for the managers in the central banks. And that is, as prices start rising, what actually is happening to the people, the savers, the people on low fixed salaries, what's happening is there's a wealth transfer from them into the lucky few who are close to the money spigot. Now, that means that those people end up spending less temporarily, at least, and it also means that the businesses that service them, you know, like some of the discount stores and so on and so forth, find their sales are hit, so they start laying off people. And the initial result of this, the wealth transfer effect, is that you end up with certainly a maintained level of high unemployment and possibly even an increasing level of unemployment. So if you're the new chairman of the Fed and you're following the unemployment statistics rather than the inflation statistics, you're probably going to be misled into thinking that the economy is not performing as it should, and you need more stimulus, not less. Whereas if you understand the effect, then actually you should be really quite worried about the inflationary effect that is coming down the line. And I think this is going to be a very interesting thing to see how it actually plays out. But that is an effect which I think we must bear in mind.
Those are great points, and not only did I expect the inflationary effect before now, I was hoping for it. And the reason I was hoping for it is that what you're describing to me is stored energy. It's potential energy. And rather than releasing the earthquake early or the cornice on the mountaintop early, we're just storing it up. And there's just a vast, vast quantity of energy stored up. And I know what the Fed thinks they're doing. They think they're in a tug of war between inflation and deflation. And because they look at the CPI, which is also the same measure used in the UK now, but whatever your inflation measure is across the developed economies, people are looking at that. Japan, you know, everywhere they're going, oh gosh, it looks like, you know, we're not really experiencing inflation. But this is because they don't put everything in that measure. They miss a lot of stuff. And to me, asset price inflation is inflation. There is no way you could possibly convince me that a house is worth 20% more this year than last year because that's what it's worth. A house is a house. It's actually a depreciating asset. It's not an appreciating asset. It requires maintenance. It's something that you will have to rebuild again. In business terms, you would capitalize it, you would write it off, and it would have a useful life, and it would go to zero. That's what real property actually is, capital property. And for all of the central banks, I think really led by Greenspan back in the mid-90s, came to this idea that asset inflation was, or they called it wealth effects. They always talked about it in positive terms, right? When the stock market's going up, we're all getting wealthier. And when houses go up, we're all getting wealthier. Not true if you're a starting family and you're trying to figure out how to afford that house. Not true if you live in a place like London, as you were just describing, where most people, based on median income, have no shot at really buying in any economically useful or survivable terms the average house over there. And so, but our central bankers got their blinkers on and they say, oh, this is great. Look at all this incredible wealth creation we have, but it's not wealth creation. You said the exact right term. It is a wealth transfer. That's the process that's happening. That's the thing that we're seeing right now. And I submit there's two stages to the wealth transfer. There's the first stage where you had the Cantillon effect or seigniorage, however you want to describe it, but that effect which says those who are closest to the money printer do the best. They get to siphon it off. First, they have first access to it. Second of all, they have different terms, more favorable terms. They get it at 0%. Third of all, you know, they get to use it before prices begin to rise. So it's great for them. But this is a really important point. If you could print real purchasing power out of thin air, it would have been discovered a long time ago. And nobody's figured out how to do it because you can't do it. You can't print purchasing power out of thin air. But it looks like you do during the first stage. And so the first stage, they print, real purchasing power is created, it's handed out to people, but it's not really real because it's been taken from people, but most people can't see where it's been taken from because the mechanism's a little slippery, it's a little hard to understand. But the second stage of this, when the wealth transfer accelerates and becomes more complete, this is when the great impoverishment happens to most people, to the unwary, to the people who are not privy to the system. And I think we're getting there. You know, it probably still has a little longer to run. This isn't your granddaddy's bubble. This is the biggest bubble in the whole world. This isn't constrained to railroads in Manitoba. This isn't constrained to Florida swampland. This isn't just housing in the U.S. or Spain or parts of Ireland. This is global. This is for all the chips. Boy, is there an investment in belief systems. They're not they, meaning I believe most of the people I talk to would fall into this camp, are not going to be willing to let go of that dream. Because when it does, it's going to be pretty interesting what happens next. And that's where I think we get back to your total fiat money supply. I think it's as simple as that. Just add up how much money there is out there. And by money, I might also broaden that. I know you have a very complete, but I'm going to call it a fairly narrow description, because those claims that you've identified on real stuff is just identifiable money. But people consider other things to be money too, like sovereign bonds. They trade like money. They feel like money. There's certain banks that consider the derivative holdings they have to be money. Anyway, there's all these tertiary claims on wealth, real wealth, houses, land, productive factories, gold, silver, you name it. The claims are accelerating I think we've gone post-exponential. I'll have to find the new term, hyper-exponential on this. It's amazing. And that's the world we live in. And that's the world where I think it's going to unfold over time. But for the people who can see it coming, it's happened before. There has to be a reckoning. There has to be a balance. All the central banks, all the politicians are hoping that the reckoning comes with really robust economic growth. And it hasn't happened. That much, at least, I hope we can all agree on. It hasn't happened.
I think that's right. You have described something which at least is two-dimensional chess, probably even three-dimensional chess. Let's throw in another dimension, and that is that central bankers do not actually understand prices. Now, the reason I say this is that if you look at the currencies, they actually, as you and I think will agree, are based entirely on confidence in the issuer of the currency. This is not like gold, where people will, have an idea of value of the currency irrespective of where they live in the world. With currency, it only has currency within the jurisdiction for which it is issued. I'll put aside the reserve currency thing for the sake of this argument. And what this means is that you have got two groups of people who could take a rather sudden and different view on its purchasing power. You've got the foreign exchanges, and you've got the actual users, domestic users. Now, the foreign exchanges illustrated this point when Iceland got into difficulties at the time of the Lehman crisis. In fact, it was virtually the same time. I think it was the fall of 2008. And between one Friday night and mid-morning the following Monday, the krona halved, literally. It just halved. Now, so far as we're aware, no kronas were issued, or no Icelandic krona were issued in order to achieve that halving. It was a fact that came out of the foreign exchanges. So we have a banking crisis potentially round our necks at the moment. We ought to bear that in mind. That is a currency effect when the foreign exchanges decide that there is risk in a currency. Now that really, if you like, overrides any idea of the quantity theory of money. Now this is something which I do not think that the central bankers really understand. So what we could have is a sudden collapse in the purchasing power of the currency. And that's the way in which you should look at all these things. It's not a question of prices of goods going up. It's a question of the currency's purchasing power going down. And that's the thing that we've got to watch out for. And if we see that beginning to happen, particularly on the domestic front, the first warning will probably come in the foreign exchanges, which is why I think the move in the dollar today is interesting. I'll say no more than that at this stage. But what I'm looking for eventually is that at some stage, people like ordinary Americans are going to start thinking that it's not prices going up, it's their money going down. If that psychology gets hold, then there is actually no hope for the currency. So that is something I think we've got to watch out for, Chris.
Oh, I totally agree. And excuse me. I was reading an interview with a major hedge fund kind of a guy recently, and he noted that all of the clients he was aware of, 0% of them were in any way hedged or prepared for inflation. So inflation being the catch-all term. But again, as you say, inflation, not rising prices. But his clients were not yet positioned for the idea of falling value of their money. But the pressures are there. When you look at real economic growth and you look at what's really happening, where we really are, you look at honestly where we are with industrial production, where we are with all of that, and then you compare that to the claims that are being manufactured, it's extraordinary, the buildup. Huge. And it just, it boggles my mind that people who, politicians fine, federal, you know, the Federal Reserve, I don't know about the composition necessarily, the ECB or the BOJ as clearly as I do, but in the Federal Reserve, they're all academicians or government types that none of them, as far as I'm aware, have ever actually truly run a business or operated in a market trading on a daily basis. So they have a fairly, I'm going to call it, isolated view of the world. But when we look at where the rest of the world is going to be, I'm really shocked by pension fund managers, hedge fund managers, people who have big money, family funds, who are looking at all of this going, yeah, I'll just keep playing this game, you know, with 100% of my assets. Like I'm fully invested. Like you've got, you know, fancy, sophisticated strategies. You're in stocks, you're in bonds, you've got derivatives, you know, you're hedged, you're cross markets, you do all of that. But if 100% of your wealth is tied up in claims on what I'm going to call real wealth, then you're still 100% invested in this whole system. So it feels to me like we're in a game of really massive game of musical chairs, and everybody's pretty convinced that they'll be able to grab a seat when they need one. I'm not as certain of that, and I'm wondering where even a light amount of fiduciary duty doesn't even seem to have crept in. When I look at the prospectuses of fairly large funds I can view, many of them have 0% dedicated to hard assets. They think they're in commodities because they own so few shares of ADM, Archer's Daniels Midland, or some Monsanto or something like that. But when I look at the companies who actually own hard assets, it's zero.
Yes, that's an interesting point. I think that the investment management community do have a problem because, I mean, you pointed out that no one in the central bank seems to have any trading experience at the top. I think that's very true. I mean, we had, I think, the last governor of the Bank of England who had any trading experience was Eddie George. Now, he just basically came up through the gilt market, and he knew how to trade. He knew how to manage a market. We don't really have that nowadays. And the other thing that has changed really over here over the last 20 years is that anyone in the markets now has degrees, and they've got all sorts of degrees, and they've been taught by universities things which they would not have learned if they were on the trading floor, and neither do they understand anything about trading. So it's really at both ends. And when it comes to investment management. The whole of the sort of investment management community is now dancing to a regulator's tune. And what really matters to them more than anything else is keeping the regulator sweet, and the customers, the clients, come second. And so much so that if we're talking about hard assets, they won't invest in physical gold for the simple reason that, believe it or not, over here in Europe, physical gold is not a regulated investment, and they are employed to manage regulated investments, so they won't do it. And so you can see that there's a sort of myopia in all this, which actually is it's degenerate. It deserves to fail. It deserves to collapse. And I'm sure it will in time. And it's not, probably not going to take very, very long.
Well, so what are you looking out for here at this point in time? And given what just happened in Washington, D.C., does this really change anything in your personal sense that maybe there's a few more snowflakes on that cornice, or does everything sort of trundle along until some unknowable point when things just give way? And I would say that's an unpredictable point. How do you view this?
Well, I think that events such as the one we had last night turn out they trigger things off. And the one thing which I think is being triggered is gold. We had a good rise today. We had about $40 rise. Now, the reason I think that this is something which is quite significant is really for a number of reasons. But if I can go back to my fiat money quantity, if I adjust the price of gold from just before Lehman Brothers went under, I think I'm right in saying that in July 2008, the price of gold at the close of that month was $918 an ounce. Now, if you adjust that price by the extra fiat money quantity that is now in circulation, gold has actually gone down in real terms, if you like, by about 30%. Or put another way, if the price of gold was to match in real terms that 918 level, it would today be about 1860. So we have this extraordinary thing where gold, for whatever reason, has become extremely undervalued compared to where it was before Lehman Brothers went under. Now, I think this is important because before Lehman Brothers went under, I think not many people actually understood systemic risk. So the price of gold did not really include a weighting for systemic risk. The other thing I would say is that since then, with FMQ, our fiat money quantity, having taken off, there is a substantial hyperinflation risk which is going to affect prices somewhere down the line. And yet gold is trading at a discount of 30% to where it was before all this happened. So it is horribly mispriced. I mean, you would have to admit that, even if you thought that it was overpriced in July 2008. So really what I'm looking at is I think I'm looking at a trigger which is likely to correct that mispricing. And it could well be that the events that we've had this last week are the beginning of that correction. And I'd also look at it another way. They've got the price of gold down. I'm not going to talk about manipulation and so on and so forth, but one way or the other, Western capital markets got the price of gold down to around about 1180 on, I think it was the 26th of June last. It then recovered somewhat. It then started drifting off. There has been so much bearish talk. You could almost say there's a conspiracy to try and get the price of gold down to somewhere between 1,000 and 1,100. And indeed, that's a target, believe it or not, that Goldman Sachs issued in a research note. Now, I mean, you know, there is such a bearish view in Western capital markets about gold, which is really based on the thought that gold is in a bear market, therefore when it rallies, we sell it. In other words, there's no thought going into this at all. Meanwhile, if you want evidence of gold being underpriced, then just look at the quantity of gold that is traveling from the mines and from the West into the Far East. The thing that's interesting is that we can get firm figures out of China, and this is not being replicated at all by the World Gold Council and others, but you can actually go to the Shanghai Gold Exchange and you can see what is being delivered. You can go to Hong Kong and you can see the import and export statistics, which are very, very detailed. And I can tell you that the annualized rate of gold accumulation in the private sector in China and Hong Kong in 2013 is running at about 2,600 tons per annum. Now, if we look at world gold mine production, it is around about 2,700 tons. Of that, China now mines about 440 tons. That leaves 2,260 tons available for the rest of the world and anyone who is not the Chinese government, because none of the Chinese production seems to leave China. We know this because you don't see any Chinese-originated ingots on the market. So the Chinese government absorbs that. So we are looking at a situation where in China and Hong Kong alone, the demand is 2,600 tons, the annual mine production is 2,260 tons, other than China's, and then we've got places like Thailand. Whoever mentioned Thailand? But did you know that Thailand's demand is running this year at around about 410 tons per annum?
Wow.
Then there is India. Now, we know that there's been a bit of dislocation in the gold market in India, but I can tell you one thing that's for absolutely certain. If you want to get gold in India, no problem. You just got to know who to bribe. And that's the way it works. So all they're doing is they're driving gold out of the official statistics onto the black market. It doesn't mean to say the demand's going down. So every way at which you look at this, there is huge flows of gold going from the Western capital markets, which are underpricing it, into the Far East, in fact, over the whole of Asia, who have a greater appreciation for it. So, I mean, that, I think, is the other evidence that gold is horribly mispriced at the current level. Now, you just need a trigger to change that, and it could be that we're beginning to see it.
You know, that fundamental argument of gold flowing from east to west is one of the more powerful arguments that I've seen in a while. I mean, it's extraordinary. It's a huge shift in events. I can't even imagine, for the life of me, gold falling under the circumstances that you've just described, from the monetary side pressing in from one side and the demand statistics from the other. And you mentioned you didn't want to go into manipulation. I'm reminded of what was that? I think it was Monty Python. It was Life of Brian. Remember, they've got the People's Front of Judea, and they're arguing with the Judean People's Front, right, about whether the Romans have, you know, they've got to go. And it's great. I think it's Cleese is saying, well, right, what have the Romans ever done for us, yeah? Well, besides the roads. Oh, I mean, you know, and medicine, right? Oh, sanitation, right? And they just keep going through this whole list of extraordinary things. There's absolutely no way we could possibly rationally think that gold would be manipulated because, I mean, after all, there's Libor, right? That was, the aluminum markets. The foreign currency. Oh, the oil markets. Interest rates, like the whole list of things you can go through that we know have been manipulated for gain. Listen, can somebody manipulate gold for gain? Yes. If they could and they could do it for gain, would they do it? Yes. Do I happen to believe that the officials who are involved in the regulatory bodies at the Federal Reserve would look the other way if perhaps, you know, with benign neglect and a half-closed eye for as long as possible, as long as gold was being manipulated for gain, but it was making the price go down? Of course. I truly believe those things. And I know for a fact, based on what I've seen on watching the tape trade, that there's something going on that's very, very, very fishy in those markets. And I love the fact that the CFTC came out after a big 100,000 hours of testimony or pages. I can't remember what the 100,000 referred to, but some quantity of discovery they'd done in the silver markets, and they're like, yeah, we couldn't find anything wrong. I was like, dude, give me a spreadsheet in 3 hours. All you need to do is break open the seal and tell me who's placing the trades, and I'll tell you if it's manipulative or not. It's not hard. And somehow they never did that. They got all those endless hours of testimony of people sitting on the stand going, well, I don't think it's being manipulated. You know, it's just like, no. Just give us the data. Show us who did those trades at 12:31 that March 8th, you know. And I want to know, were all of those contracts dumped by a single firm or set of related firms? And if they were, that was a price manipulative event because it was designed to drive the price down. And that, by definition, is manipulation. Whether they drive the price up or down, it doesn't matter. If they're doing it to move a price outside of normal market boundaries with the intention of making money off of unsuspecting honest traders, then allegedly that's illegal. And that's the world we live in. But we see it every day. We know that this is a corrupt system. It's out there. How can I think that the corruption doesn't extend to gold, silver, oil, corn, wheat, cotton, equities, options? It's everywhere. So on that front, I guess I'll leave it at that.
There is... I managed to establish that something like 1,300 tons had gone from Bank of England custody in one quarter. This was between their year-end at the 28th of February this year and sometime in the middle of June. That, I think, was interesting. I mean, the Bank of England were caught on the hop. It was their own statistics, so I was quite pleased to be able to do that. But here is a thought. If someone told me that the Italians or the French had leased their gold to a respective Italian or French bank in order to help pay some bills and make things look a little bit better rather than raise taxes, I would believe it. I would believe it. Now, the point about it is that France has got something like 2,500 tons of gold officially. Italy's got 2,500 pounds of gold officially. Spain, I think, has got something like 600 officially. I've got absolutely no evidence that they have done anything underhand or anything like lease the gold and the gold being sold into the market and ending up in the Far East. But if someone said to me, "I have got evidence that this is the case," I would not be surprised. Let me put it no higher than that.
All right. Well, no higher than that. And remember, what have the Romans done for us lately? That's...
Well, yes, I know. We keep on quoting Diocletian and all the rest of it. There is a story. We actually had an inflation in this country in, I think it was about 1132. Again, I'm going back a long, long time. I think Henry II was on the throne. And in those days, the people of repute were given the local job of casting gold and silver into coins. And they were called moneyers. Anyway, these people, well, they weren't paid for doing this. I mean, it's rather like being a justice of the peace. You know, someone of standing was given this job because they were respected in the community and trusted and all the rest of it. Well, of course, the system broke down because what the moneyers did was they adulterated the coins. The result was that the coins in circulation increased in quantity and prices of corn and various other started rising. And the problem was made worse because there was a harvest failure. They had a very bad drought. Prices of wheat went so high that people were literally starving. So what King Henry II did was he called all the moneyers to a meeting in Winchester where they were tried. And if they were found guilty, and this is straight out of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, if they were found guilty, their right hand was chopped off and the testicles removed beneath. Now, I think that sort of penalty against our central bankers might be something we ought to examine.
Well, that sounds like true accountability, something sadly missing these days, especially in the monetary masterclasses. But I'm not sure, Alistair, that we have to roll all the way back to 1130 on the first go, but there really has to be some recognition of the fact somewhere that the central banks, they're playing with lives, they're playing with fire here. And they're enriching a few at the expense of many. And history suggests that works until it doesn't. And when that breaks, well, Let's just say that it's usually best to have the bags packed and the jet engines spooled up, because a hasty retreat to a safe haven is what's usually called for there. But for me, one of the main crimes here is that by their actions, the central banks are preventing an open and honest discussion about where we are in this story and what actually needs to be done. Look, we're at potentially one of the most critical junctures in human history, and whether we get the transition right or badly wrong is a function of recognizing which things we need to stop doing, which things we need to keep doing, and which new things we need to start doing. And where I think we need to have an honest discussion about the Earth's finite limits, the Fed has prevented us from even having a reasonable discussion about fiscal limits by monetizing the majority of the recent U.S. federal debt. That enabling function of the Fed is just not helping, in the way that removing the bathroom scales from a morbidly obese person's house doesn't help. It's not the measuring devices at fault, but the practices involved. And with that cheery image left behind, as always, I've really enjoyed this conversation with you, Alistair, and I want to thank you very much for your time.
It's been very much my pleasure, Chris, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it.